This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. And coming up, heating bills are going to go up this winter, and we'll learn more about weatherization programs that can help make your home more energy efficient and help you keep your costs down. Now, control of Congress is still up in the air as the midterm election results continue to come in. Republicans are seeing some gains in the House races and are expected to take back control of that chamber, but the margin is still in question. The Senate is still up for grabs. Results are still coming in for races in Arizona and Nevada, and Georgia's Senate race will be heading to a runoff election on December 6th. Here in Wisconsin, as you heard in the news, Senator Ron Johnson's been reelected over Democrat Mandela Barnes, as the AP called that race earlier today. We want to hear what you think at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think about the Senate races in Wisconsin and across the board? What implications do you think a Republican-controlled Congress will have in the U.S.? And what about a Democratic one, for that matter? And what are you watching for as the counts continue? 800-642-1234. Email us anytime, ideas@WPR.org. Our guest, Kathleen Dolan, is a distinguished professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Kathleen, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Also joining us, Jonah Ralston, an associate professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. Jonah, thanks for joining us again.
Yes, thanks for having me.
And Kathleen Dolan, I'll begin with you. Republicans works. I saw the red wave, the red tsunami, Politico and New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, almost across the board. The expectations were it was going to be the Republicans' night. And while they still may take control of the U.S. House, they fell short of what were across the board expectations. What happened?
Well, a couple of things happened. Certainly the kind of media hyperbole often goes into overdrive, and a lot of pundits, you know, focused on the historical expectations that we had that a president's party loses seats in a midterm. They also looked at all of the headwinds that were facing President Biden and the Democrats, inflation and other, you know, sort of very close pocketbook issues about which people care. And they ignored some of the things that might have had them temper their expectations. So there certainly was some evidence that yesterday people were embracing perhaps the notion that they may not have been wildly happy about the last couple of years, but that the last couple of years have been more stable and predictable, perhaps, and our politics has been less all over the place than it used to be. And maybe people were voting for a little bit of sort of stability.
Jonah Ralston, were you as surprised as some of the pundits in the outcome from last night?
Well, I think one thing that that was missing, you know, there was a big focus on inflation, and it was the top concern, at least from what the exit polls showed. But that second concern was abortion. And I think that it got overlooked, that that was such a motivating factor for many Democratic voters. And so there was a lot of upset over the Roe v. Wade decision, you know, that being overturned. And so I think that played a pretty important role in boosting Democratic turnout. And then, you know, it was more of a red trickle than a red wave.
So there was inflation, but on the other side, there was reproductive rights. But there was also the case that Republicans made about crime. And there was the case that Democrats made about a representative republic and the threats to democracy. Did any of those issues resonate yesterday with the voters, Kathy?
Sure. You know, I mean, you know, the thing about elections is that they are multifaceted and multi-moving part events. So crime motivated some people, abortion motivated others, inflation probably motivated a lot of people. You know, there isn't one explanation. So there are certainly, I would agree with Jonah that abortion was not, you know, the pundits had decided that the interest people had in abortion and reacting to the Dobbs decision crested and was gone, and with perhaps little evidence of that. And there are cases like here in Wisconsin where political campaigns tried to suggest that crime was a big problem that appealed to some people. Other people didn't buy it.
It's Kathy Dolan, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Also joining us, Jonah Ralston, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. And before the news, we'd been talking about the split ticket in Wisconsin where Governor Evers, the Democrats, reelected to his second term, and Senator Johnson, a Republican, reelected to his third term. But that's not all the split ticket voting we saw yesterday. We saw the same similar scenarios play out in Ohio, Georgia, and New Hampshire. Jonah, what is the entrenched partisanship that we've become so familiar with? Is that defied by the outcome of the election yesterday to some degree? Do voters not see or have are willing to defy the partisanship that seems to have been so entrenched?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there's certainly been a decline in split ticket voting if you look at historical trends since, you know, the 80s, that there was a high point of split ticket voting, and it really it's been in decline since then. So polarization and the intense partisanship we're experiencing these days certainly does reduce split ticket voting. But I think you're right that, you know, it's not gone completely. And so certainly we saw this in the Wisconsin race where you had the Democratic challenger in the Senate race losing, but you had the Democratic incumbent governor winning. And like you had mentioned, you know, this scenario played out in a few other states as well, like Georgia. And it appears that in Arizona, the Democratic senatorial candidate is running ahead of what's happening in the governor's race. So yeah, we do still have these split ticket voters. You know, they're kind of like unicorns. They're hard to find, but they are there.
Well, and they did make a difference yesterday. Go ahead, Kathy.
I was going to say, I also think that people separate the offices in their mind at some level, right? I mean, they were voting for a governor and a U.S. senator yesterday, and both of those people here in Wisconsin were incumbents. And Mark Kelly in Arizona, who is running ahead of the Democratic gubernatorial candidate there, is an incumbent. And so it's always a challenge to beat incumbents, even in a year like this, where you could say, you know, that, you know, Senator Johnson was considered to be the most imperiled incumbent, Republican incumbent in the Senate. But it's always an uphill climb to vote against an incumbent. And I think if you look at the raw vote totals that we saw yesterday in Wisconsin, there's something more going on there. You know, there were more Democratic votes for statewide office for governor and for attorney general than there were received by Lieutenant Governor Barnes in his Senate race. So again, as I said, there are many dynamics at play.
One of the other dynamics, Kathy, was brought up last night in some of the election coverage was the quality of the candidates themselves and not just the party. Do the people still matter in this partisanship as you see it?
Absolutely. I think that we would be having a much different conversation today if the Republican Party had more control over who its candidates were, particularly in a couple of those Senate races. I, you know, talk with my class all the time about candidate quality, and the Herschel Walker in Georgia and Mehmet Oz in Pennsylvania, you know, stand as missed opportunities for the Republican Party from a candidate quality perspective. So absolutely, people look at the party, but there are always going to be people who, you know, have to look at the candidate themselves and feel like they're investing their vote in somebody worth investing.
Jonah Ralston, what about the Democratic strategy of financially supporting some of the more extreme Republicans in their primaries? Was that effective? What was your takeaway of that?
Well, yeah, certainly it was an interesting strategy. Well, you know, in some cases, it seems to have, you know, done well for them in terms of a strategy. But again, to Kathy's point, I mean, the bigger issue here is that really the quality of the Democratic candidate matters too, right? And so you need to have somebody who's going to be able to be competitive in those races. So even if you get the Republican you want to run against, you better have a pretty good candidate to put forward, right?
Well, and the interesting thing that you bring up about the Democratic strategy of financing or, you know, sending money into races and trying to help the most extreme Republican candidate, every single one of those Republican candidates lost yesterday. So there were lots of people who were critical of the Democratic strategy to do that. But at least in this one situation, it worked. in part perhaps because of the extremity of the Republican candidate. But as Jonah said, they made sure that they had good Democrats running against them.
So with that in mind, Kathy, is there anything we can glean from the results yesterday about which type of Republican or Democratic candidates would be successful going forward?
Well, it's way too early to take any lessons. And, you know, the problem with elections, just like with campaigns, I mean, we like to tell stories that we think make sense about why things happened the way they did. And we never know for sure, again, multifaceted elections. But I will be interested. I won't say this is going to happen, but I will be interested to see as we move away from the election in time and we get all of these final results, whether Republicans come to some sense that it is time to put distance between themselves and Donald Trump, because many of the relatively low quality candidates who didn't fare well yesterday, or who, you know, in the case of Herschel Walker, are still running, they were endorsed by the former president. And so you've started to hear strategists today talk a little bit about how this is yet one more sign that the Republicans need to move away from Donald Trump, and I'll be interested to see if it happens.
Kathleen Dolan, political science professor at UWM, and Jonah Ralston joining us, associate professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. Taking a look at the midterm election, the results, and the continued up-in-the-air control of Congress. And want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. What do you think about the midterm election results so far? Any confusion you have about when it comes to the Senate outcomes or who's going to control the House? And did you anticipate a red wave? 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@WPR.org. Our conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and we're picking up our talk with UW-Whitewater Associate Professor of Political Science Jonah Ralston and UW-Milwaukee Professor of Political Science Kathleen Dolan. They're both joining us today to talk about the control of Congress in the Wisconsin Senate race, and we want to hear from you before we're done with this hour at 1-800-642-1234. What are you worried about or excited about after the re-election of Ron Johnson, and what are you anticipating will change in the U.S. with new congressional leadership? 800-642-1234. Expected new congressional leadership, I should say. And I also want to ask both of our guests about the costs of these races. Some estimates have it approaching $17 billion for the election, and some of the turnouts that we're seeing from these elections. Can you afford to run a race anymore with a $17 billion price tag across the board at some estimates, Kathleen Dolan?
Well, you know, one of the really sort of problematic pieces, like in political science, we have a joke and we say that half of the campaign spending in any election is wasted. The problem is we just don't know which half. And we really, you know, for as sophisticated as our ability to analyze elections might be, we really don't have great data on what moves people in a determinative way that would justify this investment. But think about Wisconsin, right? Because it's ground zero for so much of this over the last several election cycles. So much money spent here. And turnout in the state was flat. I mean, it was a complete flat line. It was no different from 2018. So we don't know what people are getting and buying. I mean, did ads, you know, convince people? Probably yes, around the margins in some cases. But there's an enormous amount of money spent and a lot of ads, you know, that are untruthful or negative, and people claim they don't like them. We know that negative ads work, but I mean, so much money being spent, it's just ridiculous.
Right. But isn't some of that money at some level intended to suppress the vote or get people to keep people who would normally support a candidate from actually casting a ballot for them, Jonah?
Well, I think some of the money that's best spent is the money spent on actually getting out the vote, not on stymieing any votes. So really what you want to spend money on, right, is trying to get volunteers to, you know, make calls, to, you know, get transportation for people to get to the polls. You know, that's where you're going to have really a major impact, because you're enhancing your base's turnout. I'm not sure how, like, you know, Kathy said, it's really unclear in the literature how effective a lot of these advertisements are. I mean, I think we've all experienced it, right? You in the same day, you get a pro and a negative mailer. You know, is that really motivating anyone to go out and vote differently?
Let's go to your calls now at 1-800-642-1234, where Jennifer in Milwaukee is standing by. Jennifer, you're on the air with Kathy Dolan and Jonah Ralston.
Hi, I'm calling because I'd like to bring up the point about the primaries, the Democratic primaries. You know, right before the primaries were held, a couple days before they were supposed to be held, the Marquette University poll showed Lasry and Mandela Barnes pretty equal in terms of projected votes. And then a couple of days before the primary was supposed to happen, Lasry just miraculously or surprisingly dropped out. And so I felt, as a Democratic voter, that the Democratic Party of Wisconsin chose our candidate for us in Wisconsin rather than the people being able to go to the polls and actually select the candidate that we wanted for Senate. So I personally, as a Democrat, did not vote at all for the Senate. And I know many other people who didn't either because they were very upset by the Democratic Party making their choice for them. I also wonder if that would account for the discrepancy in the number of Democrats who voted for Governor Evers versus Mandela Barnes in the Senate race.
Jennifer, I very much appreciate your perspective.
Yeah.
And when it comes to quality of candidates, the role that a primary plays in this should not go unnoticed, Kathy.
No, and so I would say a couple of things to Jennifer, and as she says, several other Democrats that she knows. I hope that they feel comfortable with the fact that their decision not to vote for the Senate race yesterday probably really contributed to Senator Johnson being reelected. So as Democrats, if they are comfortable with that, then they certainly have the right to make that choice. But the more specific issue about the August prior, excuse me, the September, no, the August primary. The Marquette polls before the August primary had shown Alex Lasry with a decent lead over Lieutenant Governor Barnes. And that last poll before the primary showed that Lieutenant Governor Barnes had caught up to Alex Lasry. And so Alex Lasry made a decision. He may have been encouraged to do so by members of the party, but he made a decision about the amount of money he was going to invest and whether or not he was going to get a return for that dollar. And he dropped out. And part of it was because Ron Johnson was the most imperiled incumbent senator among the Republicans in the country, the Democratic Party here in the state wanted a united front in choosing a candidate. They worried that splitting the vote three ways and having a person emerge with a plurality vote would be a weak candidate, and it would make it less likely that they could defeat Senator Johnson. So, you know, Alex Lasry is a fully grown adult who made a decision for himself. But the decisions that voters made yesterday about their peak at the Republican Party had an impact on the outcome, too.
Yeah, and there is a cautionary tale here, right? I mean, if we look at 2016, there's no question that the Democratic Party establishment much preferred to have Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders. And there is some evidence that there were some disaffected Democratic voters as a result of that who did not cast their ballots for Clinton. And that probably contributed to her loss in 2016. So, you know, this is not a new story, right? This has happened
No,
before, right?
right. That's right. And it isn't a new story. But what lesson is not learned by party members is that it can work against them in the end.
Kathy Dolan, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Jonah Ralston, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. And I also want to get your take on what's expected to be Republican control of the U.S. House when all is said and done here. And it was announced today that Kevin McCarthy, who was a House Minority Leader, is expected to run for Speaker of the House to lead the Republicans. And what would that mean for the next session of Congress going forward as you see it, Jonah?
That's a great question. I think it's very likely that the Republicans will, in fact, have the House majority. It's looking less likely, right, for the Senate. And so let's assume then that the Senate remains in Democratic hands and that the Republicans take over the House. Well, I think there are three big things you're going to see as a result of that. The first being that they will use their oversight powers. And so you're going to start seeing some scrutiny of these large spending packages that were passed during the Biden presidency, for example. And there's a precedent for this. They did the same thing to Obama's Recovery Act, right? And of course, the Solyndra, controversy that erupted out of that. You're going to see the second thing would be a lot of hearings. And some of these will be focused on attacking the president in terms of, say Hunter Biden and his connections to Ukraine, whatever it might be. But we'll also see some other things, and other issues that will be looked into. And those will be mostly for political theater. And then the third thing I think we can see is that they will absolutely use the power of the purse, because, appropriations bills will start in the House. And so they're going to use that as a point of leverage with the Democrats. And I would not be surprised if we see another government shutdown, not unlike what we did see in 2013, when the Republicans had the House and the Democrats had the Senate and the presidency.
And Kathy Dolan, we just have about 60 seconds left, but if the Republicans control the House, what do you see as their agenda going forward?
Well, I think Jonah has given us a good summary of the possibilities. I think the key here is the size of the majority. It's obviously going to be much smaller than they thought it was going to be. And so, say, Speaker McCarthy is elected, his life is going to be no easier than the life of Speaker Paul Ryan, who you and your listeners may remember resigned as Speaker because he couldn't take it anymore.
We're out of time here, but I want to thank you both. Kathy Dolan, Distinguished Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Thank you. Jonah Ralston, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. Fascinating, and I thank you both for joining us for this half hour today. Both with us to talk about congressional control in the Senate race in Wisconsin and what impact that might have. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, fallout from the United Nations Climate Change Conference happening now in Egypt. Join Kate Archer-Kent and her guests as they examine the role in the United States is playing and what that might mean here in Wisconsin. Also, Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest spans more than 1.5 million acres. We'll meet its new leader tomorrow morning after 7 on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and coming up, a study into our DNA and how a 14th century pandemic altered our evolution, with its effects still found in our genetics today. But now, it might not feel like it today, but winter weather is on its way to Wisconsin, and so are higher heating bills. Higher natural gas prices are driving up costs this winter, and some of the state's energy companies are seeking to raise their rates starting January 1. Fortunately, many residents in Wisconsin can do more to prepare their homes for winter and increase energy efficiency to keep those heating bills down. And there is financial assistance available across the state to help lower-income residents pay for these winter upgrades. Our guest, Tony Francis, is the Weatherization Program Director for North Central Community Action Program. And Tony, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and you're in the North Central Community Action Program, but community action agencies across the state have similar weatherization programs to yours. So tell us a little bit about some of the services that you offer.
So our weatherization program, as you said, is a statewide program. We happen to here at North Central provide the services in 8 counties in central North Central Wisconsin. And the services that we provide are things like air sealing, insulating. We also address energy conserving measures such as, say, the aerators on your faucets, your shower heads, light bulbs, refrigerators, freezers, furnaces, water heaters, all energy consuming products you have in your home is something that we look at to see if we can possibly upgrade or replace to make more efficient.
And Tony, why are these programs so important as you see it?
Well, I really enjoy the program because it's, I believe everybody wins with this program. So yes, it's for low-income people in our state, who our clients are and we serve, but these are taxpayers' dollars. And as a taxpayer, it just seems responsible to do the weatherization work rather than spending all the money on trying to pay for the energy. If we can conserve the energy and lower the costs, Obviously, the homeowners, their bills are less, so they win. But I think overall, the taxpayers save money as well.
How much of a difference can weatherization make? And in terms of energy costs for a home, Tony, what's the bottom line?
Yeah, so for a typical average home in Wisconsin, they will save $390 annually after the first year of their weatherization. And when you figure out the materials we put into these homes and the life expectancy of them, they'll save I lost my train of thought here.
That's
sorry.
All right. We were looking at the whole cycle of the home, but
I was given a number of for North Central, but that number is true per home statewide as well. But statewide, say for example, last year we weatherized over 4,000 homes in Wisconsin, and those homes saved $1.5 million in the first year, and they will annually for the life expectancy of those measures. So that equals up to be about $36 million saved in energy.
Well, and just in the individual household, Tony Francis, the headline I saw from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is some heating costs in Wisconsin could go up $20 to $30 a month this winter. But as you detail the savings from the weatherization program from the Community Action, it amounts to more than, on average, in ballpark figures, more than $30 a month. So it could help offset some of those increased costs, which leads us to who would be eligible for these resources, Tony.
It's completely eligible income based. So you apply for how our program works is you apply for energy assistance. And that is a two-part program. Part of it helps pay for the energy bills. And then the other part is my program that kicks in and we try and save energy overall.
So how can someone who's listening to you this afternoon tell if their home's in need of weatherization?
If you live in a home, anything probably older than 15 years old, you're probably in need of weatherization. To be honest with you, we help a lot of homes and a lot of different age groups. I would just say the best thing to do is to contact Energy Assistance to see if they qualify. And if they do, we certainly would like to consider to see if we can help them.
Is there anything available for renters or landlords?
Absolutely. So this program that I run is a no-cost program to our customers, and it is for homeowners and renters alike. We help both of them, and the idea of that, whether they're a homeowner or the renter, they're using energy and spending money. So we want to save energy and save money is what we're up to.
Tony Francis, Weatherization Program Director for the North Central Community Action Program. While all may not be eligible for the weatherization assistance through Community Action, what are some common things that people can do to make their homes more energy efficient for the winter?
Well, most people think they need new windows, and usually that's not the case. However, we do get a lot of heat loss through our windows, so your standard practice of covering your windows with plastic, if possible, that's a big help. Obviously adding insulation, but that can be costly. So your biggest bang for your buck is air sealing. If you can stop the air leakage around your doors, windows, in your attics, your basement, any gaping holes or where you see air movement, that's your number one energy saver right there, is to be able to make your home as airtight as possible.
And finally, Tony, are there some areas of the home that we might be overlooking that we might not think of as being energy inefficient that we can improve upon?
If you have an attached garage, a lot of people don't consider that. But not only is that energy efficient savings available there, but it's also a health and safety thing to make sure that garage, attached garage, is not getting into the home space at all and that they are completely separated.
So, Tony, how do folks apply for this energy assistance and weatherization program?
Throughout the state of Wisconsin, you can contact your county for energy assistance. As far as the eight counties that I serve, Wood, Marathon, Lincoln, Langley, Taylor, Rusk, Price, and Sawyer, they can contact me through on our website. We have our application right on our website at northcentralcap.org.
And we have a link for that on our website at wpr.org/centraltime. And Tony, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
All right. right. Thanks for having me.
Tony Francis, Weatherization Program Director for North Central Community Action Program, with us today sharing details about how to reduce home energy costs this winter and what resources are available for weatherization. Now, it's time for Wisconsin Life, and here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about a Madison business owner and a politician who helped sponsor Cuban refugees housed at Fort McCoy back in 1980. He's also one of the people featured in the new podcast, WPR Reports, Uprooted.
Ricardo Gonzalez came to the United States in the 1960s when his family left Cuba following the revolution. Ricardo eventually settled in Madison, where he served on the Common Council and opened the iconic Cardinal Bar. When 15,000 Cuban refugees ended up at Fort McCoy following the 1980 Mariel boatlift, Ricardo made it his mission to help his fellow Cubans find sponsors in hopes of finding them a better life in the United States. The other voices you'll hear, other than Ricardo, are the hosts of the Uprooted podcast, Maureen McCollum and Omar Granados.
People who sponsor Cuban refugees out of Fort McCoy weren't just limited to southwest Wisconsin, near the military camp. They were also in cities like Milwaukee and Madison.
And one of the people who helped them resettle there was Ricardo Gonzalez. Ricardo fell in love with Madison, where he opened the iconic Cardinal Bar and Rick's Havana Club.
And while the Mariel boatlift was underway, Ricardo was also executive director of the Spanish American organization. He set off to Fort McCoy to help his fellow Cubans find sponsors.
The refugees were housed in these bunkhouses. And when we got there and I saw all these Cuban, mostly men, just hanging around with nothing, I felt the hurt that so many of my countrymen were in that situation. And I thought, this is not right. What are we going to do about it? Because I knew that I could probably help a handful.
Ricardo realized he had to choose who he wanted to sponsor.
We decided, well, let's see if there's any families. Let's start with families. Mom, dad, and the kids. Second, women.
There weren't many women.
There weren't that many single women, no. Yeah. And so I thought, let's concentrate on gay people. A lot of people were thrown in jail in Cuba for being homosexual. That to us was not a criminal offense. So we chosen, picked along those lines.
Ricardo found sponsors around Madison for the refugees, though he says most of them left Wisconsin pretty quickly.
But then there was a group of people who ended up staying in Wisconsin for a bit. When Ricardo was making those regular visits to Fort McCoy, he caught wind that a group of musicians had formed a band. Since he owned dance clubs and loved music, this gave him an idea.
And I thought, well, let's get that group to come to Madison. We loaned them some instruments and they played some kind of a benefit show. Then they had to go back to Fort McCoy, and that's when I decided to get them organized as a group, as a band, and sponsor them as a group. And that's what we did.
Wow.
We sponsored all 12 of them. I got them an apartment over on the 500 block of Mifflin, West Mifflin Street. And I remember we went to this church, and the church gave us the money we needed to outfit the band with instruments, brand new instruments, and a brand new sound system. I gave them a speech about how music is the language that breaks down the barriers. It's an international language. You don't have to speak it. You listen to it. You feel it. And that concept is what I thought would help to generate goodwill towards the refugees.
To learn more about Ricardo's life in Cuba and more about the Cuban band he founded in Madison, check out the podcast WPR Reports Uprooted. All 8 episodes plus historical photos are at wpr.org/uprooted. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Carl Christensen.
Coming up, our ancestors survived a 14th century pandemic that killed tens of millions, and a new study reveals how that's changed our genetics. Next on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret. New research analyzing the DNA of people who died from the bubonic plague and people who survived it finds that the biggest mortality event in human history influenced the way our immune systems evolved. The genes that helped people survive the Black Death nearly 700 years ago are today linked to autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis and Crohn's disease. And here to tell us more is one of the authors of the paper, Luis Barrero, professor in the section of genetic medicine and chair of the Committee on Genetics, Genomics, and Systems Biology at the University of Chicago. Luis, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you analyzed DNA from people who were around like 700 years ago. How does that work?
Yeah, so that was work done in close collaboration with Dr. Hendrik Poynar from McMaster University, who is an expert in ancient DNA. And the way it works, it's simply to be able to access genetic material from human remains. So in this particular case, were human remains buried in three London cemeteries. So the DNA was derived from about 300 skeletons. From people that lived either before the Black Death, people that died from the Black Death, and people that lived, a couple generations afterwards. So, practically speaking, the way it works usually is that we extract DNA from teeth. So we just, break it down the teeth and try to obtain, those ancient DNA materials.
And Luis, in your research, you found four genes that had a big role in determining whether someone survived or died from the plague. Tell us more about these genes and the role they played in surviving or dying the Black Death.
Yes, that's right. So we surveyed, a panel of about 350 genes, and when we start looking at signatures of natural selection that would basically allow us to determine if some genetic variants were protective against the Black Death, we boil it down to four particular genes and genetic variants. So these genes are involved in a variety of immune processes. One gene that we studied in further detail, it's a gene called ERAP2. So this is an aminopeptidase. What it does is that once we get infected with, a bacteria, like Yersinia pestis, the agent that caused the Black Death, this gene is going to be involved in cutting in small pieces the proteins that are encoded by the bacteria, and then allowing our immune cells to present those small pieces at their surface as some sort of an alert system that an infection is going on. So it's a way to call and alert other immune cells that there's an infection, and that will lead to a strong immune response against the pathogen.
So these, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so what we know that it occurs in the general population is that not everyone is able to perform this function. So there's a particular genetic variant in the genome that makes that some individuals have a functional version of these proteins, of this protein in particular, and other individuals have a non-functional version. So what we see in this paper is that having a functional version of ERAP2 was protective during the Black Death.
And so that is what inevitably evolves with the rest of us as we move on from this pandemic of the 14th century. And today, one of the genes that protected people during the bubonic plague is associated with autoimmune disease. Luis, tell us more about this.
Yeah, so that's right. So that was, somewhat, a surprise, an unexpected result that came out from the study was the realization that this same variant that I was just telling you about, for example, in ERAP2, that protected, that we predict to have been protective against Yersinia pestis during the Black Death, it coincides with the same genetic variant that today increases the risk for Crohn's disease, an autoimmune disorder. So we speculate that what happens is that, depending on context, certain genetic variants might be beneficial or detrimental. So in the context, for example, of trying to fight an infectious agent like Yersinia pestis, we probably want to have a very robust and strong immune response against the pathogen to try to kill it. In contrast, in the context of an autoimmune disorder, what happens is that our immune system is responding against our own cells. And in that case, having a strong response is going to be actually detrimental and is going to increase the risk of severe symptoms. So there's some sort of a trade-off between protection against infectious diseases and increased risk for inflammatory and autoimmune disorders.
Luis Barrero, our guest, professor of genetic medicine and chair of the Committee on Genetics, Genomics, and Systems Biology at the University of Chicago. So would you study the Black Death and killed, 50% of Europe's population in less than 5 years? Have other plagues throughout history had this kind of impact on our evolution, Luis?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about the impact in evolution. We have not studied that specifically, but the Yersinia pestis, the agent that caused the Black Death, was associated with multiple pandemics. So not just so the one that is the most known is the Black Death. So that was the second pandemic from Yersinia pestis, but there's other pandemics like the Justinian plague from 541 to 750 was the first pandemic associated with Yersinia pestis, and then more recently in the 18th century there's a third plague pandemic that also killed millions of people. I mean, to be honest, and though most people probably don't realize that Yersinia pestis, the bacteria, it's still circulating, and every year, even in the U.S., there's still people that die from Yersinia pestis. Of course, the numbers are very small as compared to these large pandemics in the past, but it's not as if the bacteria completely disappeared. In certain areas of the globe, like Brazil, Peru, Madagascar, there's still a fair amount of cases every year that are reported.
Yeah, and when your research into the Black Death, and as I mentioned, it was devastating, killing up to half of Europe's population over a span of just 5 years. Was it the scope or the sheer scale that caused this evolutionary, that influenced the evolution of our immune systems? Or was it how was it that, we've evolved this way as a result of this pandemic?
Yeah, so I think it was definitely the scale of it that allows us to see evolution in such a short time window, right? So when we think about recent evolution and natural selection, we tend to think in the scales of thousands and thousands of years. So here we are talking about evolution in a scale of a few generations. So the only way that we can see such a signature is if we are in a situation that a large fraction of the population dies of a particular disease, and not only that there must be genetic variants that increase significant protection against that same disease.
Well, it's impossible not to think of the COVID-19 pandemic and what this may portend, but then I also think of the advent of modern medicine and what vaccines have meant to our safety and survival in the midst of a pandemic. So in your role as a professor in a section of genetic medicine and at the University of Chicago, do you see COVID-19 changing our genetics?
Yeah, that's a great question that, of course, I get a lot and for obvious reasons. But it's so I think that it's unlikely that we will see some similar effects as the ones we saw for the Black Death for at least a couple of reasons. Like first, of course, we went through what we went through in the past 3 years was hard for everyone. And a lot of people died. But it remains also the case that the mortality rates associated with COVID-19 are, orders of magnitude smaller than what we saw, the 50% mortality rate during the Black Death. So that's a huge difference in terms of a selective pressure. Second, and probably even more importantly, most people that die from COVID-19 tend to be elderly people. So after reproductive age. So from the moment that you already have kids, you already transmitted your genes to the next generation. And therefore, even if you die, that's still not going to be seen by natural selection. So this is not to say that they're not going to have an impact, but it's definitely going to be, for it to have an impact, it will be over many, many, many years if the disease keeps impacting human populations.
Fascinating research. And Luis Barrero, thank you so much for sharing it with us this afternoon.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Luis Barrero, professor in the section of genetic medicine and chair of the Committee on Genetics, Genomics, and Systems Biology at the University of Chicago, talking to us about his recent study finding that the Black Death played a part in our immune system's evolution. Join us tomorrow for Central Time as we take you to Wakanda. We're delving into the Marvel Universe with a return of the Black Panther to the big screen and a cultural movement that transcends comic books. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.